From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We've moved into the studios of station KQED for a couple of days to talk to some of the many interesting people in the San Francisco area. On today's program, we meet writer Jessica Mitford. Her father was an English lord. The sisters were fascists. But she's a lifelong radical. Mitford is also a celebrated journalist, best known for her expose of the American funeral industry. Susie Bright recognizes that for many people, pornography represents the darker side of lust. But that's a side she hasn't shied away from. Coming up, a feminist defense of pornography. San Francisco-based writer Al Young remembers the first time he heard Coleman Hawkins play Body and Soul. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tells us why you don't hear San Franciscans calling their city Frisco. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Jessica Mitford is famous for several reasons. There's her investigative books, the best-known one, The American Way of Death, revealed how the funeral industry was fleecing grief-stricken Americans. When the book was published, an editorial in the conservative magazine National Review said, "The fact Mitford's written a good book doesn't mean she's a civilized human being," which gets to another reason she's famous. Mitford has been committed to radical causes throughout her life. In the 50s, as a former member of the Communist Party, she refused to give any information to the House Un-American Activities Committee, but she later wrote about the party in her memoir, A Fine Old Conflict. Mitford grew up in the English countryside, the daughter of a lord, which gets to yet another source of her notoriety. She's one of England's most unusual groups of sisters. There were six Mitford girls, including Unity, who briefly was romantically involved with Hitler, Diana, who married Oswald Mosley, the head of Britain's Union of Fascists, and Nancy, who became a popular novelist. Mitford has a new book. It's called Grace Had an English Heart, and it's the story of how Grace Darling, the heroine of a 19th-century English ballad, was made into a superstar in her own time by the press. Jessica Mitford has lived in Oakland since 1947. She's with me now in the studios of KQED in San Francisco, where Fresh Air is originating from today and tomorrow. Not only is Fresh Air in San Francisco, but public radio people from around the country are gathering here this week for their annual conference. Jessica Mitford, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
There's so much I want to talk with you about your life. Let's start kind of way back.
How far?
In your childhood, when you were a young girl from a prosperous family growing up in the English countryside, reading pacifist and leftist literature and getting very excited about it, what was the initial appeal to you of it?
Well, you know, I've thought this over since. I believe, actually, that one is very much the product of one's own time. I mean, the 60s people were a product of their time, weren't they? Now, I was a 30s person. In other words, I was born in 1917, so by 1930 I was about 13 years old, reading everything I could lay hands on, like most children, and sort of fascinated with the growing politics all around me. It was the Depression in England, tremendous poverty, huge areas called, unemployable areas. And then there was fascism rising abroad. So these things made me think.
You're talking about how you think of yourself as being a product of your time, but it's fascinating how, as a product of your time, you became a leftist, yet two of your sisters became fascists. And it's really so hard to imagine sisters in the same family growing up so different. Do you have any explanation for it?
I never have been able to figure it out myself, frankly. I've been asked that lots of times.
I'm sure you have.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, though, that some say it's sibling rivalry, which I don't believe, really. I really don't think so. I don't think we were jealous of each other. It was just that I happened to see things differently from the beginning.
Did you, because you were so opposed to fascism, did you find yourself hating your sisters when they became fascists?
Not really. That's the odd thing. I was always deeply fond of my sister Unity. I mean, she was one of my very favorite people in the world. And what I did realize was that our divergent views politically were going to inevitably lead to a huge, end of friendship, in fact, which in fact they did.
It seems to me that politics must have become much more complex to you because you knew people on the other side. It's easy to dehumanize people on the other side and just see them as the enemy and almost inhuman. But when it's your sisters who are there, you have to see it in its full complexity.
Well, perhaps that's true. Actually, you know, I mean, I'm a terrific partisan. I do take sides, and I did then too. And the fact that they were sisters didn't really alter things. I remember Unity and I saying to each other that, well, you know, if one of us should have to give the order for the other one's execution, would we do it? Answer, yes. We were pretty cold-blooded.
A strange girlhood game to have to play. You kept a running away account when you were young, money so that you could run away from home. But what you ended up using your running away account for was to try to go to Spain with the man who you later married.
That's it, yeah. And that was just right around £50.
And this was during the Spanish Civil War, and you already knew which side you were on. You kind of went from this quiet, rural, country life, the daughter of a lord, to suddenly being a political radical involved in a revolution, a young married woman married to someone who was also from a wealthy background. Your husband was the nephew of Winston Churchill.
Right, yes.
I wonder if you started to see your own families as the opposition.
Whether I ever saw them?
If you saw them as the opposition.
Oh, if I saw them as the opposition.
In the political battles you were with.
Absolutely, yeah. See, both my parents went completely on the side of Hitler, which was very surprising. We were brought up in the shadow of the First World War, in a way. And in those days, you see, the Huns, they were the filthy Huns who had killed Uncle Clem and numerous other relations in the First World War. People, of course, that I never knew because I was just born during that time. And then all of a sudden, that Hitler became a tremendous star. He did away with the labor unions, with the Communist Party. He was doing away with the Jews. And you can't discount the amount of anti-Semitism that goes on in the English upper class.
Jessica Mitford is my guest. You lost your first husband in action in 1941 during the war. He was 23 years old. You, just before that, lost your baby, who died of measles.
Born in Rotherhithe Street, right.
You were young. You were in your 20s. Did you despair at that point that your life was over? I think it must have been so hard to suffer those two losses at such a young age.
Well, also, by then, I had another baby born in 1941, Dinky Constantia Romilly, who now lives in Atlanta. She's a nurse there, in fact. And, I mean, that was ages ago. She's now 48, absolutely ancient. I can't believe it. But anyhow, she was my great standby and steadfast friend. And anyhow, you know, when you're young, I suppose life goes on, and especially if you've got a baby to look after and support. And so I got various jobs with the government and other places, you know.
Let's move ahead a little bit. You wrote about your membership in the Communist Party in your book, A Fine Old Conflict. What got you to join when you did?
Well, you see, in the first place, I'd always been a terrific supporter of the Communist Party in England ever since I was about 15. Because if you sort of studied the times in those days, you know, well, the communists were in the forefront of the fight for the rights of unemployed. I mean, an end to things like the means test, which was a rotten sort of Tory ploy to prevent the unemployed from collecting unemployed insurance or welfare. And then they were also in the forefront of the fight against fascism, both in Germany and Italy, but in Spain above all. It was the communists who recruited all the young people who flocked from all over the world into the International Brigade, of which Esmond Romilly was one, and that's how I met him. And then we sort of ran off to Spain together, you know. So that was sort of the progression of that. But we never actually joined the party, Esmond and I, in those days. After Esmond was killed, I stayed in Washington with my baby Dinky, Constantia Romilly. And so then I remarried in 1943, Bob Truheft, a lawyer who I'd met in the OPA where I was working. And that was in San Francisco. We moved out to San Francisco. And there, again, the Communist Party in those years seemed to me the absolute sort of lodestar or the kind of backbone, really, if you like, of all progressive left-wing movements, the steadfast supporters of rights of black people, that kind of thing. And this is what made us determined to join. So we did join in 1943 and remained members, in fact, until 58, which was quite a longish time.
What got you to leave in 1958?
Well, by 1958, in the first place, the Khrushchev report about the crimes of Stalin had come out. And as a consequence of that, an awful lot of people flocked out of the CP. Not I didn't at the time. That was in 1956, in fact. And then came the invasion of Hungary, and then came Czechoslovakia, and so on. And more and more people flocked out. My feeling at the time and today is that what's needed is an indigenous American movement not tied to the Soviet Union's policies. An indigenous thing, you know, that arises out of the needs of the American people, the American blacks, the American poor, the American working class, if you like, you know. And it seemed to me that the party had gone astray from that, which is the only reason that I resigned, not for any other reason. I still have lots of friends who are still in the CP and you know, write for the Communist paper and that kind of thing. But I felt that from my viewpoint, it was getting to be a waste of time. I'd be better off working with people in the main street, in the movements on campuses, for instance, in the 60s and in the black community.
So many people were harassed during the McCarthy period, and so many lives were ruined. I'm thinking that it must have been hard to harass someone like you, someone who had been outspoken all of her life, and who had already, like, a reputation for eccentricity because of her family. I mean, did you feel like, what can you do to hurt me?
Well, I did a little bit, yeah. I'll tell you what I really felt, which is that the hell with them sort of thing. I mean, we were subpoenaed, Bob Truheft, my husband, and I,
yeah.
were both subpoenaed. And I was subpoenaed by not only the main House Committee on Un-American Activities, but also the local version of the same, the California Committee, and so on. And, well, I mean, what could you do? When I was subpoenaed by the Maine House Committee, I was among 100 people. There were sort of huge headlines in the Chronicle and other papers. 100 Bay Reds subpoenaed. Well, of course, if I hadn't been one of those, I'd have been rather miffed. Do you know the feeling? Sort of rather annoyed. But anyhow, I was one. But they never finally called me. But what I found out was that they were bound to pay per diem, or was it? No, it wasn't per diem. It was travel allowance, so much a mile. And since we lived in Oakland, I put in for $40 for travel allowance for the week that I was forced to be there, and then turned over the check to the Communist Party. I hoped to annoy them somehow, you know.
Were there other things that you did just to kind of irritate the McCarthyites, to try to get even with them, again, since you didn't feel like you had that much to lose?
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, what could you lose, you know?
But, I mean, were there other things that you did to annoy? To annoy, yeah.
I can't really remember them. The main thing that sticks in mind of those days was the children. Dinky was about seven to 9 years old, that kind of age. And you see, a lot of communists didn't tell their children anything about their politics. But I always told mine, because why not? I didn't exactly say Communist Party, because that might have put them on the spot if they were ever being tortured, you know, to tell. But I told them when we read in the papers that alleged marvelous liberal Hubert Humphrey, at the time proposed on the floor of Congress, and it's all in the congressional record, to set up camps, detention camps, for dangerous people, for 100,000 dangerous people. Well, of course, if they'd rounded up 100,000 and we weren't among them, I'd have been furious. But never mind, they didn't do it. But I told Dinky, you know, they're setting up camps for people like us. And she immediately, oh, I want to go to camp. She thought it was going to be lovely sort of riding and swimming, you know, all that stuff.
Tennis.
Yeah.
In your memoir about your coming of age, called Daughters and Rebels, you wrote that you confessed that you were guiltily looking forward to being a debutante.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you ever had that that experience or not, but certainly you became a very well-known leftist and left that society world. Your father wrote you out of his will.
Yeah.
I think because you had named one of your children after Lenin, you called him Nicholas.
Yeah.
Do you ever have any regrets about leaving wealth and privilege?
No. In fact, you know, when that happened, which was in 58, I happened to be in Mexico at the time, and to the horror of the landlady where I was staying, because she somehow thought she was going to have to pay for the calls, there were phone calls from everywhere, from the London Evening Standard, from Canada, from all over the United States. What is your reaction to being cut out of your father's will? And I said, I have no reaction. I think people have every right to leave their money as they wish. And I wasn't expecting any, you know. And so sort of the deflated journalists, you know how they hate that kind of bland answer. Anyhow.
This could have been, I guess, a big thing if you were...
If I said, bah! You know, it's all screamed away or something, you know.
But you had just assumed that you
Of course. I never expected it.
And that when you make the decision to live your life as you do,
yeah,
you can't have it both ways. That
right.
was what you
Of course.
Expected.
Exactly. You said it.
I want to talk with you some more about your life and also about your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. Jessica Mitford is my guest, and this is Fresh Air.
Today's edition of Fresh Air was produced at KQED-FM in San Francisco and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Jessica Mitford is an investigative journalist, best known for her expose of the funeral industry, The American Way of Death. She's been committed to radical causes throughout her life. Her latest book, Grace Had an English Heart, is the story of Grace Darling, the heroine of the 19th century ballad who became a Victorian superstar. Fresh Air is coming to you today from San Francisco, and Jessica Mitford is with me in the studios of KQED, and they are our very gracious hosts today and tomorrow. Jessica Mitford, let's talk a little bit about your writing. You're best known for the book, The American Way of Death, your expose of the funeral industry. What led you to want to expose the horrors of the funeral industry and how they would get people when they were weak and take them for whatever they could?
Well, it is rather weird, I admit. You know, it's an odd subject indeed. I think the thing is that Bob Truhaft, my husband, who's a lawyer in Oakland, was representing numerous trade unions. And along about the middle 1950s, he began to notice, to his fury, that every time a union member died, the breadwinner of a family, the hard-fought-for union benefits meant to go to the widow and children would wind up being the price of the funeral. So he started organizing the Bay Area Funeral Society, a non-profit thing, which I thought was rather boring, frankly. I mean, I said, well, look, we're robbed every day in the supermarkets and by the landlords and things, so why pick on the wretched undertakers? Until I began reading the trade magazines.
Oh, what did you see in there?
Oh, God. Well, the titles would lead you on. Mortuary Management, Casket and Sunnyside. One, Casket and Sunnyside. And my favorite title of all, you know, which really makes you think, Concept. The Journal of Creative Ideas for Cemeteries. Well, I mean, you know, if you saw those, wouldn't you be reading them like mad? I did. And I found therein a whole wonder world of the mortuary that I'd never known existed. You know, I hadn't known, for instance, that you could have a choice of foam rubber or inner spring mattress for your eternal sealer casket and that kind of thing. And I started sending away for samples, and it was all so delightful. So then I started writing that book.
Did you go undercover and pose as someone who had a deceased loved one so that you could shop for funeral arrangements and see what it was like?
I did quite a bit of that. That was one of the best parts of it, especially Forest Lawn in Los Angeles. That was tremendous fun.
What was the experience there like?
Well, I mean, I went there. Actually, I went with a young man who is an American fellow who was teaching English history or something in one of the colleges there in Los Angeles. And so we made up that he was my nephew and I was his English aunt. And my sister was dying or something, you see. And we wanted to make pre-need arrangements. So I said we want to see everything. But in those days, by the way, Forest Lawn was there was a price war on. And Forest Lawn was advertising on billboards funerals from $145, you see, which sounded very reasonable. So I said to the grief therapist, they're not salesmen, you know, they're grief therapists. I said to the grief therapist, well, we want to see everything in the nature of all the coffins, and I can choose the best, most appropriate. So the first one we came to was $16,500. Now, you have to realise, we're talking in the early 1960s. So you can double that or triple it or whatever for the inflation, what it is. And I must say, it was rather magnificent, you know. And I looked at it longingly. And then I said, well, could we see the $145 one? And so, you know, he took ages finding it. It was sort of hidden away somewhere. And, my dear, it was purple. It had a purple, really hideous. And I said, I looked at it, and I said, my sister wouldn't be caught dead in that sort of thing, you know. And so then we kind of went along and saw all the different plots and blah, blah. And it was great fun.
After writing The American Way of Death, did you find yourself in the position of having to genuinely prepare somebody's funeral and having to shop for real in the funeral industry?
Yeah, I have once or twice. But my favorite thing in that line, there was a man called Howard Gossage, extremely well known in San Francisco, but he died many years ago. He was a wonderful, he was an ad man, advertising writer. And when he was, he did all those marvelous things in The New Yorker about the getaway car. I mean, it's all years old. I don't know if people remember it. But he was much more than that. He was a brilliant and funny fellow in all ways. So he was dying of leukemia. We knew he was dying and not expected to live. So one morning about 4, 5 a.m., his brother-in-law rang up, and who I hadn't met. And he said, Howard died in the middle of the night, and his last words to me was, when I go, and I think it'll be very soon now, be sure to get hold of Jessica, because she knows how to nose out the cheapest coffin in this whole town. So you know how when somebody dies and the survivors, you know, you always sort of say, or people say, well, what can I do anything? And the answer is no, obviously. But in this case, yes was the answer. So I went and collected the widow, who was a beautiful young actress. And together we went, my God, I got one for $150 all in. You know, and he was a rich man, and he would have been considered a super prize for the undertakers.
Now, there was a casket named after you after your book came out, right?
A
kind of bargain basement budget kind
well,
of casket.
It was
casket.
Such a marvelous idea. A sort of industrialist in the Middle West had plans and specifications for the Jessica Mitford casket, which was going to be sort of made of plastic, I think, or something like that.
Did they really make it?
I'm not sure. I never actually saw one. My sister Nancy said, oh, well, we all know that you get 10% royalties on those Mitfords.
Have you made real plans for how you would want to be buried? A lot of people, like when they're very young, buy plots.
Yeah.
Or there's like, you know, a family plot and they know that that's where they'll be. Or they make plans for cremation and they let everybody in their family know what they'd want. You know, if...
Of course, what I'd like is to go full fig. You know, the embalmers can take 20 years off your looks and everybody come, have a sort of huge bash, you know. But I'm afraid that's not going to happen. I'm afraid it's going to be what the undertakers call burn and scatter.
The
for me.
Cremation.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was upset reading in your book that even in cremation there's ways that they get you.
Oh, of course, yeah. Look, there's nothing more, you know, seductive than a prophet. And they're no more, really, they're probably no more far out than any other sort of small businessman, but they sure do make a profit from everything.
Is your choice of cremation purely kind of price-oriented, or is it also like a practical thing of not thinking that we should take up space underground?
Well, it's a bit of both, you know. Yeah, actually, if you just bury the person without a coffin, they do lots of good to the garden.
Can I ask you about this? In 1984, on a trip to Nicaragua, in a women's delegation, I believe you suffered a stroke.
Yes, I did. A very slight one, thank God.
This is everybody's nightmare, right? You're going to be traveling in a foreign country, and you'll be taken ill.
Oh, my advice to you is, if you have a stroke, have it in Nicaragua, because the people were so incredibly good to me. I can't say how nice they all were.
Really?
Oh, God, yes. They were wonderful. And they got me, out to a plane. And that it was very difficult travel and all that. And they really turned handsprings to be extremely wonderful.
So were you treated there, or were you
No, well, there isn't really any treatment.
States?
What happens is that there is no real treatment for stroke. I mean, they do try to find out sort of how severe it was, which they do by various kind of electronic things. They certainly haven't got those in Nicaragua. And anyway, who wants to be a burden on Nicaraguan people, you know, having your health looked after when they have all those problems. So I thought to get out would be best. No, there was no treatment.
What were the effects of the stroke on you?
Well, not too bad. I mean, this hand sort of didn't work at all, and that was tiresome, but then it came back completely.
Was that through therapy, or did it happen
no.
on its own?
No. By the way, interestingly, and then one leg got done in a bit, and it's still not too good.
Since we're broadcasting from San Francisco today, I wanted to ask you what's kept you in the Bay Area since 1947, if you found this a particularly hospitable place for you.
Well, I do love it, but I'll tell you what, I mean, Oakland, well, if you say you live in Oakland, it's rather like, you know, saying you live in Jersey City instead of Manhattan. And so I once did say to Bob, shortly after...
Your husband.
My husband, shortly after we moved. See, his law practice is in Oakland, and that's really what keeps us there. I said, by the way, do you think we'll be living the rest of our lives in Oakland? This would have been in perhaps 1950. And he said, no, of course not. And here we are, at the end of our lives, still in Oakland. I think one gets a certain sort of lethargy about moving.
Jessica Mitford, I want to ask you about your new book called Grace Had an English Heart. And this is basically the story of the woman around whom a now famous a British ballad was written. Tell us briefly what the story the ballad tells is.
Well, it was about the fact that this 22-year-old girl who lived in a lighthouse off the coast of England, off the northern coast, had helped to rescue 9 shipwrecked people in the year 1838. Oh, well, why don't I sing it?
Please.
Will you join in when I say help, help? I'll give a signal.
Oh no. This is my nightmare, having to do a radio sing-along.
It goes, 'Twas on the Longstone lighthouse that dwelt an English maid, pure as the air around her, of danger ne'er afraid. One morning, just at daybreak, a storm-tossed wreck she spied, and up spake brave Grace, darling, I'll save the crew, she cried. So she pulled away o'er the rolling sea, over the waters blue. All together, help, help, she could hear the cry of the ship, wrecked crew. But Grace had an English heart, and the raging storm she braved. She pulled away all the dashing spray, and the crew she saved. Anyhow, that was the song we all used to sing. And she always stuck in my mind a good bit, Grace Darling. You know, I mean, she was a very brave girl. She was 22 years old when the rescue happened, and this was in the year 1838, 1 year after Queen Victoria came to the throne. And Grace Darling sort of personified all the Victorian, rather boring virtues, I'm sorry to say, that also Mrs. Thatcher would endorse, wouldn't she? You know, sort of piety, chastity, obedience to authority, all those things. Anyway, I got interested in doing the book, and to me the most interesting part was how the press hoopla began in such an early time in history. In other words, in the very early 1930s.
Did this song have an influence on your childhood? Were you supposed to live up to the model of Grace Darling?
I don't think so. We used to sing all kinds of stupid songs, including all the sort of 30s songs, you know, like I've Got You Under My Skin. We weren't supposed to live up to that.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Jessica Mitford, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. I thank you very, very much for joining
us. Well, thank you. I've loved every minute.
My guest has been Jessica Mitford, and her new book is called Grace Had an English Heart. And she joins us today at the studios of KQED in San Francisco, where Fresh Air is being broadcast from. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jessica Mitford, would you sing us out to the end of the program with perhaps another verse of Grace, Darling?
You mean another verse?
Is there another verse?
Okay. What do you mean another? About 8 verses.
Oh, please. Well, keep going.
They to the rock were clinging, a crew of 9 all told. Between them and the lighthouse, the seas like mountains rolled. Said Grace, come.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From San Francisco, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is visiting San Francisco for the next couple of days, coming to you from the studios of KQED. San Franciscan Susie Bright describes herself as contributing to a new wave of erotic literacy. Coming up, she defends a few taboos and tells us what she's learned editing women's erotic fiction. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, lives in San Francisco, and he has a warning for us. Don't call it Frisco. And San Francisco-based writer Al Young reads a jazz memory. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The Pentagon has decided to offer flights out of Panama to all military dependents who wish to leave the country. Some dependents and U.S. embassy workers have already departed Panama on military cargo transports over the past few days. But Defense Department spokesman Dan Howard says the Pentagon will now begin chartering aircraft in an effort to expand the effort. Howard says there's no panic behind the move. Rather, he says it's a matter of space.
We simply don't have housing accommodations for all these people on our military installations in Panama. They're doubling up with sponsoring families on the installations. This is something that we can do for a short term, but obviously it's not a long-term solution.
There are an estimated 14,000 U.S. military dependents in Panama. The man widely believed to have won the annulled presidential election in Panama left the hospital today. He has been recuperating from last week's brutal attack by thugs supporting military leader General Manuel Noriega. Opposition leader Guillermo Endara said there could be no deal with Noriega. From Panama City, Alan Tomlinson reports.
A defiant Endara said there would be no retreat from the opposition's widely proclaimed victory in the annulled election.
This is the will of the Panamanians, and it was clearly and very clearly exposed. This, for us, is the will of God.
Endara sidestepped the question of whether or not he will now form a provisional government to challenge the legitimacy of General Noriega's hand-picked regime. Endara said the Panamanian people were now looking for the clear support of other Latin American countries, which meet tomorrow in an emergency session of the Organization of American States. The opposition wants a diplomatic quarantine of the Noriega government and has called a general strike in Panama to coincide with the U.S. meeting in Washington. The government has declared the strike illegal amid threats of retaliation against those who observe it. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Panama City.
The White House today expressed some skepticism over Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's reported assertion that the Soviet Union has halted weapons shipments to Nicaragua. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that President Bush is waiting for Gorbachev to match his words with deeds, and Fitzwater accused Gorbachev of playing a PR game. Federal investigators today began probing the cause of the Exxon oil spill in Alaska. Most of today's questioning was directed at the tanker's third mate, the officer in control when the Exxon Valdez went aground. Robert Hawks of member station KSKA reports.
The tanker's third mate, Gregory Cousins, told National Transportation Safety Board investigators he was giving helm orders to avoid colliding with small icebergs when the red flashing light of a marker buoy was spotted directly in the path of the tanker. Under oath, Cousins said he ordered a hard right turn to avoid the hazard, but when the 987-foot ship was slow to respond, he knew disaster was imminent and notified his boss.
I called the captain, and I said to him at that time, I think we're in serious trouble.
Seconds later, the tanker was impaled on a reef, spilling its cargo of North Slope crude oil. The ship's captain is charged with operating his vessel while drunk. Cousins testified he had no indication the captain was under the influence of alcohol. That issue will come under closer scrutiny as these hearings continue. In Anchorage, for National Public Radio, I'm Robert Hawk.
The Senate voted today to back a U.S. agreement with Japan to jointly develop a new jet fighter. The FSX deal was supported by the Bush administration, despite claims by opponents that the deal will help Japan develop its own commercial jet industry. The 52-47 vote means the deal will proceed regardless of a pending vote in the House. Stock prices fell on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 10 points, finishing the day at 2453.45. This is NPR in Washington.
Fresh Air is broadcasting from San Francisco today, so we've invited Bay Area poet and novelist Al Young to do a reading. Al Young has written three volumes of what he calls musical memoirs, remembrances inspired by recordings of jazz, blues, and rock and roll. This memory relates to Coleman Hawkins' 1939 recording of Body and Soul.
My father, who used to bicycle 30 miles one way to court my mother, had this record among his dust-needled 78s. He'd already worn out several copies before I learned to love it from memory, never knowing until much later what a cause it had stirred. Imagine it's 1939. You talk about a hell-raising year. That one had to take the cake, with Hitler taking Czechoslovakia, Bohemia, Moravia, and Poland. With Stalin taking Finland and Poland. Poor Poland. Franco taking Spain, Great Britain and France declaring war on Germany, Mussolini taking Albania, Stalin and Hitler signing their infamous non-aggression pact that would splinter and split all the left-leaning parents of kids I would later meet at college and beyond. My own folks, peasants and proles, knew next to nothing about the left wing or right wing of anything but chickens. But they did know right from wrong. Politics to them had something to do with money and power, which in white Mississippi were one and the same. History and truth are so easily misconstrued. Even dates, names, facts, and figures can lie.
Aught's an aught, figure's a figure, all for the white man, none for the nigger.
Depending on who's doing the dating, doing the naming, doing the figuring. The telling of truth is the poet's proper domain, and in the head-whipping nations of this darkening, fact-ridden world, people still look to poets and the music they make for light, sweet light, illumining everything, everywhere. If it's true that in this alleged 1939, the New York World's Fair World of Tomorrow ran for 5 straight months, and that TVA got the Supreme Court go-ahead, and that TV in the U.S. was first broadcast publicly from the Empire State Building, covering the opening of that same World's Fair, then it's equally fair to imagine Coleman Hawkins in that crowded year. In October, the Golden Gate Bridge closed down for repairs, while on the 11th day of that same month, Hawkins, just back from a rewarding stay in war-hungry Europe, repaired to the RCA Victor New York studios with some musical friends and cut Body and Soul, just like that, in the shadow of the Empire State Building. You can even picture him slouched in front of one of those weighty old condenser boom mics, surrounded by smoke, suspended and hatted, thinking something like, well, let's see how what I'm feeling's gonna come out sounding this time, so we can get this session wrapped up and get back to the gig and really do some blowing. After the take, he probably remembered how he'd performed this Wee Hours ballad better 100 times before. I'll get it down yet, he told himself, but this'll have to do for now. And children, that was that. When the record came out, saxophonists all over the world, hearing it and sensing that things would never be the same, started woodshedding Hawkins' impassioned licks in their closets and on the stand. Why do you have to go and do that? Of course, everybody fell in love with it. My father would play it, take it off, play something else, then put it back on. This went on for years. What was he listening for? What were we listening to? What did it mean? What were all those funny, throaty squawks and sighs and cries all about? I knew what a body was, but what was a soul? You kept hearing people say, well, bless his soul. You thought you knew what they meant, but really, you could only imagine, as you must now. You knew what they meant when they said, bless her heart, because you could put your hand to your heart and feel the beat. And your Aunt Ethel sometimes fried up chicken hearts, along with gizzards, livers, and feet. But a soul was unseeable. Did animals have souls too? Did birds, dogs, cows, mules, pigs, snakes? bees? And what about other stuff, like corn, okra, creeks, rivers, moonlight, sunshine, trees, the ground, the rain, the sky? Did white folks have souls? Was a soul something like a breeze, something you couldn't picture or grab, but could only feel like you could the wind off the Gulf when the day cooled down, or the way the ground would tremble when the train roared past across the street from where we lived? 39, 40, 50, 100, thousands, who's to say how many rosy-chilled Octobers have befallen us, each one engraved in micro-moments of this innocent utterance, electrically notated, but, like light in a photograph, never quite captured in detail, only in essence. Essence, in this instance, is private song, is you hearing your secret sorrow and joy blown back through Coleman Hawkins, invisibly connected to you and played back through countless bodies, each one an embodiment of the same soul force. All poetry is about silent music, invisible art, and the clothing of time for the ages.
Al Young's three books of musical memoirs are Bodies and Soul, Kinds of Blue, and Things Ain't What They Used to Be. This is Fresh Air. You're probably aware of the part of the feminist movement that opposes pornography on the grounds that it objectifies and degrades women. But fewer people are aware of a parallel movement of women who see themselves as sexual radicals, feminists with bad girl fantasies. These women don't want to eliminate pornography, they want their own, and one of the women supplying it is my guest, Susie Bright. In answer to the question, what appeals to the female erotic imagination, she edited a book of erotic fiction by straight and gay women called Herotica. And she edits a magazine of explicit photos and fiction called On Our Backs, which is billed as entertainment for the adventurous lesbian. On Our Backs is published in San Francisco, where Susie Bright has lived for 7 years. We're here in San Francisco with Susie Bright at the studios of KQED, where Fresh Air is originating today. You describe yourself as part of a new wave of erotic literacy. What is erotic literacy?
Well, I like to say that American culture is erotically illiterate. We don't know how to read dirty pictures. We don't know how to discuss sexual art. We get embarrassed. There's a stigma. It's criminal. It's private. It's this. It's that. It's anything but a profound part of your life, which, of course, it is. Sexual entertainment, sexual media has been the most concrete old boys club that you can imagine. Because the whole idea was only men like this stuff, women don't like it. If women want to be sexually aroused, they listen to seashells and look at flowers blooming. Well, that's ridiculous.
Have you ever been sympathetic to the anti-pornography movement? And I guess I'm asking too, have you ever seen or read a piece of pornography that really deeply offended you, that made you really angry and that you felt was somehow depriving you as a woman of part of your humanity?
A lot of the description you're using has the rhetoric that the anti-porn movement applies to people's fear of explicit sexual imagery and of sexual fantasies. If you were to ask me, have I ever seen a story or a picture that scared me, that had a sexual impact that frightened me or made me anxious? Yes. You ask me if I have a sympathy. I have a sympathy for the position women find themselves in of sex being a threat, a peril, something that maybe if you got it out of your life, you'd be better off, because it's disease, it's unwanted pregnancy, it's being used, it's being exploited, it's not getting what you want. These things have so typically been a feminine dilemma with sexuality. And of course I'm sympathetic with that, because that's I grew up here too. I'm not a Martian. What I have found that has revolutionized that sense of fear and anxiety for me is to understand, acknowledge, and take hold of one's sexuality, to possess it for yourself.
What bothers you about the anti-pornography movement?
Everything. that they take some of the most vicious and backward ideas about human sexuality and about women's identity and just send us back another, you know, 20 years, 50 years, the idea that there's something really sick about sex in and of itself. They don't identify with a conservative religious point of view, and yet I find there is something so similar between the two. It's a condescending view of women and a view of men as if they were animals. I don't mean just any animal, like, you know, crazed beasts. And to me, that contributes to a lack of understanding between the sexes and a lack of understanding about human sexuality.
In On Our Backs, the magazine that you edit, there's a lot of rough stuff, a lot of stuff that would strike people as really kinky, a lot of S&M stuff, a lot of women photographed in leather and harnesses and things like that. When I look at some of the S&M-type images, it looks really similar to all the mass-market S&M type of stuff. And I wonder how you feel about that as someone who wants to, like, you know, create erotic literacy and a new kind of sexual language and everything. If you feel like you're just using the same old stuff that's always been around in mass-market pornography anyways.
I feel like making fun of this. I feel like saying, if the shoe fits, wear it. If the leather shoe fits, honey, tie it on. What do we mean by stock S&M? How many people have seen fetishistic SM pornography? Hardly anyone. If you saw it, you'd be surprised. I'd say On Our Back stuff is much more romantic and much more like fashion photography than it is like hardcore SM material.
There's a lot of scenarios that have to do with risk and danger.
Yes.
That you've edited. And I think some people, if a fantasy like that entered their head, they would try to self-censor it.
Mm-hmm.
And think that this isn't a fantasy I particularly want to have. Let me have a kind of a nicer one.
Mm-hmm.
have you ever done that yourself? Did you ever go through a period of self-censoring those kinds of fantasies? And do you think there's anything wrong in having fantasies that have risk and danger in it?
Of course, I've been through that period. I'll never forget a time early in the days of when women's studies was first making its impact on college campuses. I was in a program at Cal State Long Beach, and our class was very close, and one woman started crying and brought up this that she had fantasies of being raped and how disturbing it was to her, and the whole class, it just pulled us all together, and we all talked about our feelings, and the consensus at that time was that the patriarchy had just addled your brain so badly that until you could get that kind of internalized self-hatred out, you were going to have these fantasies, but we should be kind to each other and not think that we really wanted to do this just because we were fantasizing it. Well, my last sentence, the distinction between fantasy and reality, is the only thing I agree with now. Because, of course, I have those kind of fantasies. But when I started investigating what a fantasy is made of course you realize that in your fantasy, even though you, let's say you are helpless, okay? I'm going to take the helpless side for a minute, the victim side. But you control every moment of the victimization. It unfolds exactly as you would imagine. You get scared to a certain degree, and then something else happens. Whereas in real life brutality, as an unfortunate person who has been mugged a couple of times, it was completely out of my hands. I was scared to death. It was hideous. It had nothing to do with being sexually aroused. It had nothing to do with a pleasure of empowerment.
I wonder what kind of response you've been getting by feminists and lesbian feminists to the pornography that you have been editing, I think it's really very controversial among lesbians and feminists.
It is and it isn't. The sort of big secret is what Spiro Agnew called the silent majority. I mean, On Our Backs is the most popular lesbian periodical that's ever been published. If you looked at the debate, the mainstream debate, you would think that only a handful of perverts were subscribing to our magazine, but in fact, it struck a nerve among lesbians of all classes and all backgrounds that no other lesbian publication ever did. It broke out of the lesbian feminist insular clique that I was a part of. I didn't know how many different kinds of lesbians there were until I started doing this magazine. But because the lesbian feminist press has been controlled by a certain elite point of view that is like, you know, out of a 1972 grave of understanding of what lesbianism is, feminism is, it's a very strange thing. On one hand, it has done so much for our political power, and on the other hand, it drives people away.
What's happening now with more kind of underground women's pornography being written is coinciding with the spread of AIDS, and it's I guess it's a paradox in a way. And I wonder what you make of that, if you see any connection or...
I've thought a lot about that. One way I find it threatening, because I'm afraid that with AIDS and sexually transmitted disease that women will retreat from doing the sexual work that we're doing now, and it's so important, I just can't bear to go backwards. Sometimes it frightens me. Other times I talk about what I call the silver lining of the AIDS epidemic, which is that people are talking about sexuality in an explicit fashion and in a caring fashion that they never have before. And we have people on the 6 o'clock news mentioning anal sex. I mean, it's incredible. It's kind of the language that is being used that wouldn't have been before. And that is to our advantage because it is bringing sexually intimate discussion into the public light.
Susie Bright, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Susie Bright is the editor of Herotica, a collection of women's erotic fiction, and the quarterly magazine On Our Backs, published in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Noah Adams in Washington. Coming up today on All Things Considered, the second day of the Gorbachev visit to China. We'll have a report from Beijing and a review of the past 30 years of the enmity between China and the Soviet Union. Also, this question, should Ronald Reagan, former President Reagan, join the classic American visages on Mount Rushmore? Emmett Terrell, the editor of the American Spectator magazine, believes so and is trying to raise money to that end. Also, NPR's Daniel Zwerling reports on repetitive motion syndrome and the way it affects office workers, not just those who work on assembly lines. And we'll have a winning short story, complete 250-word story from Texas. It's called Mockingbird. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
We couldn't do Fresh Air from San Francisco without checking in with our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, who lives here. Since we're visiting his city, he has some pointers for us about how to converse with the natives.
Hi, Terry, and welcome to San Francisco, city of fog and nicknames. It's been called Baghdad by the Bay and the city that knows how. That one was bestowed by President Taft in recognition of the miraculous rebuilding after the 1906 quake. Of course, there were some wags who were mindful of the fact that another big one might strike at any time. They took to calling the place the city that waits to die. And the nearby town of Colma, which is mostly cemeteries, is sometimes called the city that waits for the city that waits to die to die. But you can call it whatever you like, the city of love, the big artichoke, the place the sun forgot, or just plain SF. One piece of advice, though, don't call it Frisco, not if you don't want to set the natives to choking on their sourdough bread. Strange that a city should be so disdainful of its nickname. You Philadelphians seem to be happy enough with Philly, and it's hard to imagine Los Angelinos getting shirty about calling the place L.A. And the name Frisco has romance. It conjures up the wide-open days of the 19th century, the age when San Francisco enriched the English language with words like hoodlum, Mickey Finn, and the verb to Shanghai. Frisco, its North Beach and the Barbary Coast, Frank Norris and Dashiell Hammett, Harry Bridges and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. In short, it's the kind of nickname that most chambers of commerce would pay a bundle for. But at some point, the local nabobs decided that Frisco was too undignified and coarse for a modern cosmopolis. And then the local columnist Herb Cain put the final kibosh on the name in 1953 when he wrote a book called Don't Call It Frisco. Cain himself has recanted since then, but the taboo has stuck. It isn't that modern San Franciscans are embarrassed about their past, either real or imagined. This is a town that put up a plaque on the spot near Bush Street where Bridget O'Shaughnessy was supposed to have bumped off Miles Archer. What really keeps San Franciscans from using the word Frisco is just that it's the word that all the tourists use. And San Franciscans have a thing about tourists. It's not just because tourists run so thick on the ground. The real problem is that they're so promiscuous about leaving their hearts here. When I lived in New York, I used to take a satisfaction in hearing people say that New York was a great place to visit, but they wouldn't want to live there. And I'd think, of course you wouldn't. Only a real New Yorker could stand this place. It's a characteristic of all the world's great cities that they're too unbearable for anybody but the natives. Either they're too dirty or too crowded, or the air is unbreathable, or the people are rude or just plain crazy. That's what makes the inhabitants of those places seem like special breeds. But folks come to San Francisco, and they go predictably gaga over the hills and the bay and the bridges and the cable cars and the Victorians. Even the fog can be romantic if you don't have to live through a whole summer of it. And pretty soon they're thinking, gee, I could live here. Anybody could live here. The city is so congenial that its inhabitants come to seem completely unremarkable. The tourists don't regard us the way that tourists regard New Yorkers or Los Angelinos or Parisians, with a mixture of awe and fascination. They treat us with a familiarity that borders on presumption, as if it were their city, too. Not surprisingly, this drives the natives wild. That's probably why we San Franciscans spend so much time talking about what makes us different from everybody else. And, well, there's one difference at least. We don't call it Frisco.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. We're in San Francisco again tomorrow. Our guests will be Bill Graham, arguably the world's best-known rock impresario, and Mickey Hart, the drummer with the Grateful Dead. He's just produced a new series of world music records. Also, our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, plays the music that preceded the psychedelic bands in San Francisco. And Stuart Brand, the creator of the Whole Earth Catalog, examines life in the Silicon Valley, the Bay Area's high-tech mecca. So I hope you can join us for another broadcast from San Francisco. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia.
We'd also like to thank some of our friends at KQED who have made today's broadcast possible. Station Manager David Hosley, Program Director Carol Pearson, Promotions Director Doug Edwards, News Director Ann Marshall, and engineers Stuart Rosenthal and Steve Rotman. And special thanks to Monte Carlos, the Operations Manager, who's made it all work. He's even brought us good weather. The WHYY Fresh Air team is Danny Miller, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, Chris Burton, Deborah Beagle, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and yours truly, Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.